front of the door, it's Dave!
Who?
Dave! D-A-V-E!
Dave?
Right, man, Dave.
Dave's not here!
Hey everyone, it's Dave, and welcome to another edition of Just What Do You Think You're Doing, Dave? On today's show, I wanted to talk about surveys. Surveys are one of those things, it's a tool that people can use to understand how things come together. Sometimes there's no other empirical measure you can use, so you do a survey to figure out kind of how it's going or what people think. And especially in the cases of customer service, they're kind of helpful in a way because you want to know how you perform, how the company performed. And how was your outcome and how did that work? So they can be useful in that sense, but not always. Sometimes they go a little too far. Sometimes they're asking the wrong questions. It's almost as if they're just sending you a survey, but they don't know what the context was of the original inquiry. So you wind up answering questions that seem like they're irrelevant in some way. And it's kind of a weird thing. And then of course, there are political surveys, the ones that you see all the time on the web or you get phone calls about. Do you think such and such is doing a good job? The problem with these surveys is they're very leading and often are presented by the organization that's either supporting or attacking that other person, right? Somebody who's on the other side of whatever issue or on the same side. And so they ask questions that are very leading. And so they're really not meaningful in any way. And then you'll hear approval rating. You know, this person has an approval rating of whatever. What does that mean? Who did they survey? How many people were in it? What kinds of people were asked the questions? What questions were they asked is sort of other things that might help you grade what it is. Or you're just asking one question, do you think so-and-so is doing a good job? It's not really a fair question because it's very misleading that way. Large companies that do the surveying that you hear about sometimes, some of these large survey companies, they do okay because at least they have some understanding of what the survey is, how it works, what it means, and there's a little bit of information that can be gleaned from what they ask. But these smaller companies, or especially the ones that are politically motivated or the ones that are part of the campaign themselves, those are all nonsense. Then the things you get out of it are kind of meaningless. And even when the results are reported on, sometimes they're kind of bogus too, because you see the results and you go, wait, what does that mean? What are they trying to tell me? How does that actually work? It's kind of a weird thing because the surveys themselves are flawed in some way and you're trying to interpret results without any context to it. Now, I remember when I was growing up, there was a commercial on, I think it was for a toothpaste company, and they used to say 9 out of 10 dentists agree, whatever. And I think it was about the toothpaste, and they talked about, you know, this one's preferred. And the question I always had growing up was, who's that 10th dentist? What did he or she think? And what was the question you asked them that said that they preferred this particular toothpaste brand? It was very strange because it was just a weird and misleading sort of question. And they were just sort of promoting their product by saying dentists like it. Was there actually any validity to what they did? Was there any science behind what the question was or questions were that led 9 out of 10 dentists to agree? It's kind of a strange thing. And if you stop and think about it, you realize that there's really no significance to any of this. This is all social science. There's no empirical thing that you can get, generally speaking. There are some things you can do to improve on that, but you have to be very careful in how you apply it. Now, I have to admit, when I was growing up, I used to watch The Family Feud with Richard Dawson. And I'll also say, as a guilty pleasure, I sometimes watch the current version of Family Feud with Steve Harvey. I think Steve Harvey's pretty funny. And I think the show is kind of amusing if you just kind of take it with a grain of salt and just look at the way people are. It's kind of fun. But there's always this question. We surveyed 100 people and tell me about something that's something, right? And the answers that they come up with, they should add up to 100 because it's how many percentage of the people of the 100 people, how many said this, so it's sort of like a percent. So in a way, they did a survey and they're giving you the survey results and you're supposed to interpret the survey results. So from a scientific standpoint, it's actually kind of funny in its own weird way because you're interpreting these scientific results in some way. But I've always wondered, who are these people they survey? How do they survey them? Where do they survey them? Where do they come from? Who are these 100 people that they talk to? And because they have so many questions that they do every day, and there's so many shows that they do every year, how do they get that many people to do the survey and, you know, keep going with these different surveys? Or is it all just made up? Is it just nonsense? I've always kind of wondered about that, and I don't really care what the answer is. It's just sort of an empirical thing that it's kind of funny when you think about how this comes together. You know, it's like, what are these surveys? What do they mean? And it's that reality that the survey itself can be kind of meaningless. So when you're designing a survey and you're thinking about how a survey comes together, it's important to understand a couple of things. And there's a couple of key things that you should look at. There are some pitfalls in a survey design that a good designer will try to overcome. And as you look at a survey and you think about what the survey is asking you, if you decide to take one or you decide to look into what the results were from one, you have to think about considering a couple of things. When you ask demographic questions, when you see those demographic questions, sometimes they're unnecessary. Sometimes they're irrelevant. Sometimes they just take too much time. And sometimes it feels like they're just sort of fishing for information. So you have to be careful how much information you're going to give out. A survey company should really already know a lot of this information when they prompt you for the survey. And when you get them from customer service organizations, generally they're already kind of populated with this stuff. You're just answering some questions. But you want to be careful if you go to one of these random surveys and try to answer questions, because the demographic stuff, sometimes, you know, they're using it to try and understand where people fit into different categories. Are you one party affiliation or the other? Do you make this much money? Do you live in a house or do you rent? You know, those kinds of things, they're helpful because they help them understand what people's views are. But you have to be careful asking those questions and answering them, because you don't know what someone's going to use it for. There's a problem with, you're going to ask so many questions and you don't give enough variability in the answer. When you put a couple of questions out there and the questions don't cover enough range, you know, like it's that thing about, how long have you been a customer of this company? Less than 1 year, 1 to 5 years, or 5+ years? That's fine, but it really, what are you using that question for, and how would someone answer that question? If they just went less than 1 year or 5 or more years, what about the people in between? It's confusing. What do I answer? How do I answer that question? There's the rating levels, and I'm going to come back and talk about those in a minute. When you're doing a scaled rating and you're saying, you know, we're trying to say that it's 1 to 5 or 0 to 10, the surveys, when they make the mistake of either changing the scale to be a smaller or larger scale, or changing the order of things so that it's agree is at a 1 or agree is at a 5, and they switch it at some point, it gets confusing. And, you know, they've got to make sure that they're laying out the questions correctly, that makes sense. There's also the problem of assuming some sort of prior knowledge of something. You have to, like, help people understand what it is that you're asking for. What is it you're trying to get to? You don't want to be ambiguous or, like, leave something out, leave something to chance. Using your own internal company jargon or industry jargon or something like that, you want to make sure that you're putting something out that's meaningful and relevant to someone. Using acronyms is always a problem, right? You need to make sure that you're not confusing people. One of the biggest ones, and my biggest pet peeve, is leading questions. Those are the ones where it says, do you think that so-and-so is doing a good job? That's a very big leading question, because I'm asking you if I think that they're doing a good job. If I'm producing it from the political party that's saying it, then it's likely that I'm going to respond to it very emphatically if I'm receiving this survey from that party and I'm a member of that party and I like the person. Whereas if I ask the question a different way, I might think about it differently and answer it a little differently. Another problem is these double-barreled compound questions. When you put and or in the question, you make it a very lengthy question. If you do this and this, and you had that and that, and or you did this and this, what would your answer be? Those are very confusing and misleading. And those get very complicated. Also, when your question is completely ambiguous, when you leave it very open-ended and you don't say anything, or it's unintelligible and you say something like, the word not in there, I do not think that so-and-so is doing a good job. That's misleading. Which way do I answer that? Do I mean yes or no for that? And then the answer choices, sometimes when you put agree and disagree as your answer choices, that gets kind of confusing, because it's like, wait, am I agreeing with the statement or disagreeing with the statement? And that's actually generally confusing anyway, because people get confused about what the question is and the context of the question and what they want to have there. a good survey designer will also think about the questions and making sure that they're giving relevant questions and not asking a lot of unnecessary questions. Questions, sometimes these things become too long and people talk about things and it's just like you keep asking questions. It's page after page of questions. That's another problem that you've got. And sometimes you'll start these surveys and it's like, you know, they say the survey is going to take 5 minutes and you're 5 minutes into it and you have no idea. There's no context clue about how long the survey is going to go on for. Is it going to go on for another 10 minutes? Am I at the last question? If you're doing something online, you want to make sure that it has some sort of marker, indicator to tell you that how far along you've gone. So you want to be careful with that. And similar, you want to make sure that there's not a lot of open-ended questions. Because if you're having a lot of space where you're having people put free-form text, some people are going to write text there. And if you're sending the survey out to a lot of people, that could be a lot of text that has to get reviewed. Even if you're putting it through machine language and reviewing it, somehow that always has to be reviewed. So you have to be careful when you're doing that. So as you think about these things, right, think about the surveys you've taken in recent days, because I'm sure everyone has taken a survey. I take them sometimes when I get them from a company. What I tend to find is the ones that come from companies that I've done business with and I have a complaint about, those are the ones I'm most likely to take. If it was a really great experience and I really enjoyed it, I'll take the survey then too, because I really want to give some good feedback. But those middle-of-the-road experiences where nothing good or bad happened, I'll generally ignore those because it's not worth my time, I think, to go through and do the survey. Now, if they're giving me a little something at the end, I might. You know, giving me a little tchotchke or a free dessert or something from a restaurant, sure, I might do it. But you have to be careful about when you choose to do that and how often you choose to do it. And, you have to think about these. They're sending out thousands of surveys and they're expecting a response rate. And that response rate could be 10% for all you know. Now let's talk for a minute about designing good surveys. So in the early 1900s, this guy named Rensis Likert was coming up with this idea for how to do better social studies and how to understand things better. And he came up with something that he called the Likert scale. And the Likert scale is really that idea of doing surveys in the range of like 1 to 5, where you're saying you agree on a 5, you disagree on a 1, and 3 is a neutral. You're starting to really tightly get some more information that's meaningful. And what he did was he did a bunch of different experiments and looked at what was the most effective way to get responses that would be meaningful in some way. So he had done this work and he figured out that doing the scale was actually pretty useful. It was actually kind of helpful to understand what people thought if you gave them these scales. And there's a second thing that he did that most people kind of forget about that's really important and you don't see it in surveys enough. It's this idea of creating a second question that backs up the first one. So when you create one question that says something that's asking an opinion or something about what people think, and you're asking that 1 to 5 scale, you want to ask a follow-up question somewhere else in the survey that's a slightly different version of it. You've got to be intelligent about the way you think about these things, but which is reinforcing the point you made on the first one. So in the first one, if they answered a 5, on the second one, you want to try and get something that's similar to the 5. You don't want them to come back and say it's neutral. You want them to say something similar so that you see the same result. So you're creating similar questions that reinforce the previous question that you've asked. And it's a really complicated thing to do. It's not easy. You have to really think about what question you're asking. Again, back to that idea of good survey design. What question am I asking that will actually help me to understand what the result is? When I ask this question, what's my expected outcome? And if you really think about it and you come up with a good, solid question, you can typically come up with another question you could ask that would be in that same vein, but would reinforce what you asked before. So it's really important to understand how to do that and make it fit in some way. And that's why these surveys are so important. You know, if you're going to do it and make it meaningful in some way, there's something you can do that that makes it better. Now that's back to, this is not specifically scientific. If you do this well and you do it right, you can use statistics and some mathematics to figure out what the results mean. You can actually go through it and do something meaningful with it. But the challenge is, and this is the big challenge, you have to be careful in how you apply your statistics as well. But there's a big two-part question that's out there. The first part I've already talked to you about. It's, who are these people I'm surveying? What's the right demographic that I'm going to look for, the people that I'm going to survey? And the second part is, the more complicated one, how many people do I use in my survey to create a good survey that I can then use in a statistically significant way? I remember talking with a professor in college about this. We had this philosophical discussion about a lot of things. And I remember talking about this idea of surveys and how many survey questions should you ask and what should you do? And how many people should you survey? You know, there's a general standard that as long as you have an N of 20, a number of people is 20, you can have some meaningful statistics. But if you wanted to really know something and you wanted to really understand it, is 20 people enough? You've got a demographic of over 300 million people in this country. Can't survey all of them, but you have to survey a statistically significant number of them to get a good result, and they probably have to come from different locations. So I remember him having a discussion with him one day about smoking. And if you were going to survey people and ask them, does smoking cause lung cancer? How many people would you need to survey in order to get something meaningful in your result? If you surveyed 100 people and they were all smokers or from the tobacco industry, you would probably get an answer that would give you, that would lean more toward no. If you surveyed more of them as doctors, you might get an answer that leans more toward yes. But is 100 people enough? Is 1,000 people enough? Is 10,000 people enough? What's the number that you would want to survey in order to get something meaningful? And how would you break down the number of people that you would survey? Where would you get them all from? Some of them might come from different states, from different things that they're doing. Some of them might be doctors. Some of them might work for the tobacco industry. Or maybe up front, you put some questions in there that allow you to segregate your data in some way. See, here's the problem, right? That's the issue. When you start to look at it that way, the whole thing becomes a little bit different in the way that you look at the problem you're trying to solve. So what was the question? Why did I ask that question? Why would I ask about whether smoking causes cancer? I can show that mathematically it does. And I can show that, you know, there's an empirical nature to it. But the survey might show me something different. And as these trials, this was at the time there was all these trials going on against the tobacco industry from various people who had smoked, right? This was kind of the crux of that point, was that when you're trying to put together these juries and you're asking people that question, those questions, you're trying to understand how they're going to respond so that you can get the best outcome depending on which side of the trial you're on. But it's tricky. How do you do that and make it meaningful? Now, one other story I wanted to tell, and this was kind of an apocryphal story. It's one of those things that was kind of fun. Back in the 1960s, you know, the U.S. economy was booming. People were starting to get to work, and we were starting to build a greater economy. We were doing all these things, and there was some disposable income that people had. We're moving more to the suburbs, and people had some extra money they wanted to spend. The Chevy Corvette was on the market and was one of those cars that the enthusiasts loved. It was sporty. It was fast. It was a two-seater. It had a certain appeal, a mass appeal. And Chevy was literally raking in the money over that car. It became this thing everybody wanted. And Ford wanted to get in on that deal. They're like, we could make a car like that, couldn't we? So they went to their engineers and they said, come up with a car that, you know, fits our model that we could sell to people that would make it kind of fun, a sporty car that people would want to buy. And so they came up with the original Ford Mustang. And originally it was a two-seater, and it had a similar styling in terms of the way it the horsepower and sort of that, the style of being the sports car, that sort of thing. While it looked different than the Corvette, it was kind of similar in a sense, right? There was a lot of things about it that were alike. And the Ford executives, I think Lee Iacocca might have been the CEO of Ford at the time, they thought it was great. They were like, wow, we want to get this in the marketplace. So they started conducting market research. And they were trying to figure out whether people would want to buy this car. And they found that there wasn't a market for it. You know, families didn't want to have a second car that was a sports car. And people already had a car. And the car was for getting around town and taking the kids to school and maybe going on a little road trip. The car wasn't for sports and fun. That was, you know, that was the single guy's game. And Corvette already had that market locked up. So Ford sort of put the idea on a shelf for a while and let it sit for a few years before they tried reintroducing it. The story goes that there was a problem, and the problem had to do with the way they asked people about the concept car. They had created one. They had brought people in for focus groups. They had asked questions about the car. But the one critical question they asked was the question, could you see yourself driving this car? And people would generally answer no, because, you know, I'm a family guy and I've got these things going on and I don't want to drive this car. It's too sporty. I'm not interested in it. But when they brought it back off the shelf, And they went back out and started asking people survey questions. They revised that question. And they asked the question, could you see your neighbor driving this car? And universally, the answer was yes. Oh, my neighbor's a flashy guy. He'd really like driving this car. He thinks it'd be great. You know, I'm sure he would really buy one because it's a really cool car. It was the same group of people, the same demographics of people they were asking a different question to, and it wasn't that long in between. A couple of years maybe between them, I don't know, something like that. But the question they asked was so different. And so they decided to go ahead and put the car into production and release it to the marketplace. And it was a huge success. It's still a success today. And in fact, that's the one that they've decided to market as their electric vehicle. So it's the Mustang Mach-E because it has that Mustang title to it and it makes things really compelling. It has that connection to their past because they want to make it sporty and they want to sell the car. So the car was wildly successful. And through the 70s and into the 80s, that was, you know, it was that or a Corvette. Those were your two cars. Those were the cars people bought. You bought one of those two if you wanted to be sporty. Between the 60s and the 70s and into the early 80s, if you wanted to be a sporty guy driving a car, you drove the Mustang or you drove the Corvette. Now, the Mustang, they did make one change to it, and that was to put four seats in it. So that way they could make it a family type car too. So they made that. Now, to be fair, Ford did make one change to the car that I think was relevant, and they made it a sports car, but instead of making it a two-seater, they made it a four-seater. You had to fold down the seat to be able to get in the back seat, so it wasn't exactly useful, but you could still make it that sort of family car if you wanted to. You could get other people in the car. It wasn't just two people in the car. So in a way, they kind of reinvented their market a little bit and rethought their process. But the biggest problem they had was just in that survey question. So you have to kind of think about surveys because sometimes you miss that point that surveys can really be misleading. Just by asking the wrong question, they caused that car to sit on the shelf for a couple of years. Imagine how much further along they could have been, how many more they could have sold, what else they could have done, had they just rethought their survey and done something a little different. So I just find that interesting. It's one of those moments when you realize just how important surveys are. So as you go out after listening to this podcast and you hear people talking about surveys and why surveys are, you know, what this survey told us and what this survey told us, whatever it is, be a little skeptical. Think about it carefully. How many people were surveyed? What was the demographics like? You know, you're just getting a number, 66% approval rating, 33% approval rating, whatever the number is. What does it mean? What significance does it have? It's a barometer, it's an indicator, it tells you something, but is it really meaningful in any way? And that's what you have to stop and consider sometimes. What were the questions that were asked? Who was asked? I've never been called for any of these surveys. I've gotten some generalized surveys about politics, but I've never gotten any specific ones where they're asking that question. Yeah, I'm one of 330 million Americans, so it's unlikely I'll ever get called, but it's interesting that I haven't. So anyway, that is my story, and that is my podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed it. And remember, if we can dream it, we can certainly do it.
What's your point, David?